Welcome to Oncology Data Advisor, where we explore the latest advances in cancer research and patient care. Thanks for listening to this episode. Be sure to visit oncdata.com for more content, including expert perspectives from leading oncology thought leaders, FDA approvals, patient advocacy, and much more. And don't forget to subscribe to Oncology Data Advisor on social media to stay up to date on the latest videos, podcasts, and more.
Hi, everybody, and thank you so much for joining this special edition of Oncology Data Advisor in honor of International Women's Day. We have a really unique discussion planned for today with members of our editorial board and fellows forum. So without further ado, we can have everyone go around and introduce themselves, and then we can, you know, launch into the discussion. So would you like to start off with your introduction, Dr. Talker?
Sure. So hi, my name is Richa Talker. I'm a second year hemonc fellow at Northwell Health, and I'm also one of the members of the fellows forum. And I'd like to pass this off to Dr. Khan.
Hi, everyone. My name is Nitha Khan. I'm a first-year fellow in medical oncology and palliative care and also part of the Fellows Forum. And I'll pass it off to Dr. Lauren Ghazal.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lauren. I am a family nurse practitioner and an assistant professor at the University of Rochester and also the Beaumont Cancer Institute. And I'll conclude it with Dr. Kaur.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gurbakhsh Kaur. I am a multiple myeloma specialist, as well as, I do auto transplant and CAR T at UT Southwestern. I've been practicing about 5 years now, four years now.
Awesome. Excited to talk with you all today. So in light of this discussion for International Women's Day on March 8th, I would love to hear all of your perspectives about being a woman in the field of medicine and specifically in oncology. Richa, we'll start off with you.
So I feel like it's definitely a mixed bag. A lot of times, especially in certain clinics, it's really rewarding to be one of the first few females in the group. And oftentimes what I've noticed is patients actually gravitate to you because of your gender. But the other thing too is, especially because oncology is so demanding, it's also very hard to manage like a work-life balance. Have any of you guys ever noticed any of these issues?
Yeah, I agree with Richa. I think it definitely can be either or, but first and foremost, it's always rewarding and to be able to kind of bring your unique perspective to your patients. And yes, also true. A lot of patients, sometimes specific to the type of clinic you're rotating through, gravitate towards a female provider. So I have found that rewarding. There's always, you know, challenges and obstacles. And then in terms of work-life balance, I think there's a unique set of challenges in that realm too, specifically being a female healthcare provider.
Yeah, I would, in being on the nursing end, more research as a PhD nurse scientist, I just attended the Women's Leadership Summit, and a lot of the discussion was on women being a mom and having to manage, you know, childcare in addition to being in healthcare, whatever role it is. And I'd like to challenge our dialogue around Women's Health Month and awareness that it goes beyond, women can have outside lives outside of their careers in addition to being a mom and being a caregiver. And I think that when it's reduced to just childcare responsibilities, I think it also is another reflection of like, okay, what are we talking about when we talk about Women's Health Month or women's health roles and responsibilities? I would also say, I mean, nursing is a different beast, and we are the majority, of course, overwhelmingly women in our profession, and that's another conversation. But there are other intersectional challenges too, with being BIPOC, being LGBTQ, having a disability, and being a woman. And I think that that also warrants some discussion too.
I'll go next. I think I have the unique perspective over here as someone who's been in practice, who've sort of been where, Richa and Nida have been as fellows at that time. I think I didn't really, when I was in fellowship, I certainly didn't experience I didn't really pick out the fact that I was a woman and that was a different thing. I don't think I had the way I was treated or the way the challenges I felt in my field were unique to me being a woman. Maybe I was just shielded because there's GME, there's so many other factors that sort of, form a protective layer around you as a female in medicine. That does change as you grow up and you kind of go into practice. There are definitely unique perspectives, and you're right. The conversation when we talk about Women's Day doesn't necessarily have to be a role as just providers or just as moms, right? Okay, how's, the question I get often is like, so when I go to conferences, so who's watching the kids? I'm like, their other parent, and that's my husband actually. So it's almost like people are sort of shocked that I could go for 5 days and not have to worry about childcare or don't have to give a list of an outline of the food is here, that is here. I never really have to do that. I have a wonderful partner. My husband is a wonderful partner and a parent. You're right, the conversations can go beyond that. Our roles are beyond that, but there are definitely unique perspectives of being a woman in medicine, especially when you want to do it all. And I've sort of had to adjust that perspective that you can have it all, but just not all at once, right? At each point of your life, you sort of adjust, what am I going to focus on right now in the next 2 years of my life? What am I going to focus on the next 4 years of my life and all that? So I think each phase of your life, you sort of have to shift gear and reassess and reprioritize. If we constantly keep on doing that, I think there will be a sense of fulfillment. I do have a almost 8-year-old and a 3-year-old. So clearly, 2.5, 3 years ago, I was just surviving as a new mom and as an oncologist and someone who was interested in academics and wanting to get my research off the ground in the COVID world, post-COVID world. And that has reevaluated. My kids are older, they're more independent. And I don't have to be always be there to take care of every part of their life, right? And now I've shifted gear. And I don't know, there are, I think one thing I've realized is that with each phase, whether you're a resident, whether you're a fellow, and then you're an early career physician, there are different unique challenges with that phase of your academic growth.
So I feel like both of you guys brought some very good points. And what I think most people gravitate towards when you say work-life balance is usually like being a wife, being a spouse, or being a mother, or like a grandparent or a care provider for someone else in your family. And to me, it's just like as women, I think so much of our identities is put on a specific label. And to me, like work-life balance is just anything you do outside of work. And I think it's really important for especially women to just branch out of a single label and try to build up a life outside of just whatever you do at work too. Because no matter what you do, your work is going to be stressful, but whether it's hobbies or family or anything else that you do, that's really going to reinvigorate you and make it easier to like carry on your day.
Awesome. I love all those points that you guys made. I'd love to hear a little bit more about each of your specific branches of practice. As I know, Lauren, you mentioned nursing is more of a female-dominated field. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, about your perspectives as being a practicing physician, a fellow, a nurse practitioner, and kind of how you view International Women's Day in light of those.
I can start, and also drawing attention to nursing is very, very different than medicine, and it still and probably will always be a predominantly female profession or specialty. So there's different challenges therein that present itself because of that. I think when we think about gender representation and nurse leadership, for one, so two things: nursing leadership, and then also the gender pay gap in nursing that I'll talk about. There's a quicker trajectory or pipeline for leadership and tenure among male nurses than female nurses. We know that nurses are underrepresented in healthcare leadership roles in general. I think about 70% of our global health workforce are women, but And nearly 90% are nurses, yet only 25% of senior healthcare roles are filled by those identifying as women in general. For the gender pay gap, we know that male RNs report on average about 15,000 more per year in earnings. Not surprisingly, this gender pay gap is more significant for BIPOC women. And this pay gap, unfortunately, has been found to widen during the pandemic. And some reasons for why this is, and we think about men and women in nursing, is that men are more likely to negotiate their salaries. And I'd love to hear how that is in medicine too. But also, men are more likely to report working more hours per week. And of course, this can be from just perhaps having more flexibility with working overtime, picking up extra shifts. And again, this is for folks who historically do not take on more caretaking responsibilities. So that's two things I wanted to kind of bring to light, was just the trajectory to leadership and then the pay gap that still exists in nursing.
I can sort of go next and reflect upon the challenges of being a female attending, and I think I'm actually quite astonished that there is such a discrepancy. I was not aware, because I would think that because it's a female-dominated field that there would be a more of a straight path, or a trend towards women being represented in leadership. And this is very much similar to what happens in medicine leadership. How many chairs of divisions or departments are actually female in comparison to their male counterparts? How many women get promoted from assistant to associate to professor? And there is a big discrepancy when you look at from a gender perspective, for sure. I'm sure, from a perspective of race and other factors, that's true as well, but definitely from a gender perspective. So I just learned something today that I did not know, that was such a huge issue, even in nursing, which is very female dominated. And I think you said the correct thing, is that I think women don't tend to negotiate. I certainly didn't know that art when I started out my attending journey, but I'm pretty good at it right now. And I think the key is, Richa and Nida, as you go on to your journeys of completing your fellowships and looking ahead for jobs and or your friends, is to reach out. Don't be afraid to reach out to other female physicians who've gone through this journey on what you could advocate for yourself, how to negotiate. And there are, we have such wonderful forums, actually. There's a physician moms group on, it's called PM. But they have different, respond. There's so many different sub forums within that, but so many great people that you can meet over there, or mentors outside of your institution, not just within, who you can reach out and discuss what's important to you, what you want to negotiate, what you want to work on. So don't be shy. I think don't. That's what I've learned. That's been my journey. That I don't think early on I advocated for myself as much. And then there's an art to it, and you learn as time goes on and you get wiser, and you learn to have distant mentors, close mentors at your institution, that can help point you in the right direction.
I can go next. Can give like a fellow's viewpoint. I actually was the other day, I was counting what year of training I'm in after high school, and I think this is like the 13th year or something. And so when you've been like 13 years of medical training and you're in fellowship, which is what you've always wanted to do, and you're basically at the point where you're learning and in training and having this influx of information thrown at you, and you want to be the best of the best and be taken seriously. And so in fellowship, that's kind of your goal, to like learn as much as you can, because in a few short years' time or a few months' time, you're going to be basically on your own in attendinghood. And so I think that's always been my priority. As a woman, who's also a fellow, I think there's also everything else going on in terms, and specifically in medicine, and that you want to be taken seriously, right? And I think going through residency and going through fellowship is always like a thought, well, are my male counterparts being taken more seriously than my female colleagues or than myself, even though we have the same training. And that's kind of like an undertone through it, throughout residency, throughout fellowship, maybe like little microaggressions that you notice, things like that that you pick up on. And I think really the best thing for me, or how I've dealt with that, is just kind of falling back on my training and be like, hey, I know my stuff. I haven't gone through 13 years of this to like not be confident in what I've been learning. And so I think that's kind of the unique perspective of a fellow who's like almost done with training, almost, at the point where you've been kind of your goal is within sight. And so to always keep that in mind. And thank you, Dr. Kaur. I will definitely take in that advice about the negotiating because I'm about to enter that part of life soon. So
Reach out anytime.
Yeah, I will say my experience as a fellow is also very similar to Dr. Khan's too. My journey is a little unique in that I did a palliative care fellowship, so I finished and then I went back to do a second fellowship as a hem-onc fellow. So I never worked as an attending in between, so I was still getting my feet wet as like a palliative attending while being a hem-onc fellow. And one thing I struggled with was the biggest imposter syndrome. Things that I could do completely easily in my sleep, maybe in June of my palliative care fellowship year, so basically graduating. The second I went back to being a first-year hem-onc fellow in July, I would quadruple check my calculations on opioids, even though like I knew what was right. And sometimes my attendings that weren't trained in palliative care wouldn't really know how to dose some of the medications as well as I did because of my other fellowship. I still doubted myself, even though like I had some more training. And I think there's all, especially as a woman in any field, there's always this sense of if someone questions you, you think that you're wrong, not so much that they're just trying to learn from you too. And it takes a lot of time to build up that confidence, not only in like your abilities, but also to show it once you actually build it up and feel confident that you do know something.
You talk about imposter syndrome. I think that is that bogs us all down, no matter how experienced we are when it comes to having ideas. I've even throughout my early years of I'm still I would say I'm early career, but if I have an idea, I would question if it's a valid idea, and then I would see a counterpart, and a colleague somewhere else who would execute it and wouldn't. I think and that has to do a lot. And we can't, I think it does impact our academic progress. So the way to get over it is to talk about it and to reassure each other, hey, you know what? Like Nida said, I didn't go through 13 years of training and education just to end up here and question myself again. And it's good to question, it's good to double check and all that. So, you have to have all those. You can never be too confident or fully, cocky. That's the right word, right? So, the double check is part of our medical training as well. But to have doubts about our ability, is something that I think hinders progress for women in academic medicine. That's something we need to keep on talking more about it. Unless we do, we're not going to get over it.
I mean, I think one thing I find actually really interesting is I did another panel and I was the only female on the panel with three other male colleagues. And in that, even the decorum of speaking was very interesting because people would jump in and interrupt each other and the flow kept going. Except one thing I've noticed too in this meeting is everyone's taking their time and taking their turn so that to be extra respectful of the other person that's speaking. And I think sometimes these skills are very important, but in other situations, like when someone is looking for leadership, these softer skills that I think sometimes you see more often in women are overlooked for other more like assertive or confident like skills, or at least the appearance of more confidence too.
Yes, you're very much right. This happens. I think more and more research have come about underrepresentation of women, whether it's ad boards or, whenever there's a conference going on, who are the moderators or the speakers. There is an effort, right, within our respective academic institutions, also societies such as ASH or ASCO, to sort of change that. I see what Lauren has wrote, the mantles. Yes, they are there, but I think there is an effort. It's not completely fixed yet, but at least there's recognition and awareness. So I think progress is happening slowly but surely. We just have to keep in mind, but you made excellent points. When there's discussions going on, who speaks more often? It's like whenever there's an issue going on, if the male counterpart is speaking, they're called, they're assertive. They have a leadership skill. And one of the challenges I've seen is that, oh, if you're being assertive as a female, then you could be, you get the label. And that's something we have to fight in medicine. And I'm sure that's true of other professions as well, because there is certain stereotypical expectations we have of the gender.
Totally. You can show the same level of assertiveness, and in a woman you'd be bossy and difficult to deal with, but a man, oh, great leadership ability and very direct, and it just spins it into a positive. I'm curious, and you both shared some experiences with seeing these all man male panels, the mantles. I put in the chat and realized it was recorded and people can't see the chat. Have any of you been in the situation where you were asked to speak and you were like, I want to see who the other speakers are, and whether it's because you wanted to make sure that there was representation for, your specific area of medicine, or representation for women, or representation for whatever it was. And then I just had a difficult conversation where I had to then kind of think about how am I going to strategically go about this with communicating. I don't want to be an only up there, and I shouldn't be just a checkbox on something.
I think you're speaking to very junior members in terms of academic, ladder. I would say I haven't, me personally, haven't been in that situation where I'm the only one. There have been several other females, and I've had great champions. Some of my greatest cheerleaders are he for she, mentors. My mentor at UT Southwestern, Larry Anderson, who's like, recommended me for committees or recommended me for a trial, even though I was a very junior faculty. So we definitely have that. So far, I haven't been part of such situations where there's only one female, but I do know of more women physicians and leaders in our fields who've been in those situations, and they've advocated for such changes.
Dr. Kaur, I think you also brought up a really good point about like leadership and mentorship. What do you like for, I guess, all of us, what have you guys found that's been really helpful with sponsorship or leadership, and how have you guys seeked out opportunities? Because I think sometimes it's just very hard to move up to the next step, and having someone's experience as like advice for what you can do to move on to the next step is really valuable.
I think part of it has in my I think I found mentors in different places at different times of life, right? I have obviously, Larry Anderson, who's one of my mentors at UT Southwestern, but I've also have mentors elsewhere who I've reached out to discuss opportunities, what my research interests are. And if it's in line, if I can grow that. So I think you have to just be willing to reach out to people. And sometimes you may not get the response that you want. That actually works. That's worked for me. So I wouldn't say I have one particular member. I think I have a tribe of women that I go to when I have that. I have friends. And then I have had mentors who are in different academic institutions, some are in medicine, some are actually not even in medicine, how to navigate, who just are good and effective leaders. So that's helped me out. So I think seeking out other people who you may have something in common with actually helps you advance your cause.
I forget the phrase that you use. I use a sponsor or someone that really puts your name out there, suggests you for things, and says, you know, there's an ASCO podium set. I want you to do this. You should put your name in there, right? I didn't realize the extent of that person until my postdoc fellowship. And the director of my postdoc's fellowship just was able to serve in that role, a sponsor of, you know, and to be able to communicate, I want these opportunities. If there's ever an opportunity, can you please bring my name up? Can you please, you know, put my name out there and be on a committee to speak? There's a lot of power that comes into that relationship that's really different than a mentor or a collaborator. I don't know if any of others have had those really special sponsor experiences.
The way you have put it, yes. It was, I think Richa who brought up the sponsorship part. I didn't, I've had friends who've used the word sponsor in between, and I didn't really get it because to me it was sort of equivalent to a mentor. But I do get it. There is a distinction. And sometimes your mentor could be your sponsor, and other times your mentor is not going to be your sponsor. They have two different expectations, and the relationship is going to be different. And you have to, seek it out. For me, social media has been wonderful, actually. So I've had a chance to collaborate with people, collaborate on research project. Rahul Banerjee, he's the editor in chief. Am I correct, Kira?
Yep, that's
Right. So
correct.
he, I feel like, he's become a great friend, and we collaborate, and there's a lot of, encouragement, on his part. So you just seek people in different spaces.
Absolutely. I love these points that you all made. These are all such fantastic insights. I'd love to hear some more as well about ways that you personally have come across to that help to overcome these obstacles or these biases that you experience. Rita, for example, you mentioned imposter syndrome. Is there anything that you personally have found that can help you overcome that? As far as things like the gender pay gap, I know, Lauren, you do a lot of public advocacy work, things like that to kind of get your voice into the field, things like that, or any tips that you would have to share for other women who are either currently in your field or who maybe are starting to embark on their careers in this field that you would like to share with them, and especially in light of International Women's Day.
So, I guess I can start with something I learned at ASH this year. So, every year, ASH does this thing called Ashapalooza, which is meant for trainees. And I know I probably shouldn't have said this after the training session, but one thing they discouraged us, like a phrase that they discouraged us from using, was basically saying imposter syndrome. Because part of the connotation of imposter syndrome is that you're an imposter, you don't really fit into the mold. And the thing is, it's the world isn't necessarily always built for minorities or women or just people that are not right at the mean and median of every single measurement, right? So if you look at surgeons' tools, they're built for like patients with or like people that have glove sizes that are like large, not small people with smaller hands or extra large hands. And there's nothing wrong with your hands if they're just a little off from the surgical tools. But the point that they made at ASH was basically instead of saying imposter syndrome, just to keep telling yourself when you're faced with a microaggression, it's you belong in medicine. And the idea was that you will always face so many obstacles, so many microaggressions, and it's going to make you feel like this isn't your place. And even saying that you're an imposter, like you have imposter syndrome, will make you feel like whatever role that you're taking on isn't really meant for you, and you're taking an uphill battle. But when you tell yourself, this is my place, I do belong here, it changes your mindset. And then also, it's self-motivating to help you accomplish what you want to do.
That's an interesting perspective, because that again says that the imposter syndrome is your own issue. That is a great perspective or a different perspective. I think one of the ways I have felt it is, or at least I've made a change in my life, is that I think once you know your craft, if you know your craft well and you know what you're doing well, the confidence is always going to come in. It is reasonable that when you first start out, for you to be humble, for you to know that you don't know it all, and that you're not going to get the best opportunity for at that time, right? That it's going to be a growing pain. And you have to remember, I consider this as a marathon. I want to love medicine 20 years from now. I don't want my fuel to run out because I was chasing something within 5 years of it. And that perspective has changed a lot of how I see that I want to accomplish things. Was there a lack of confidence? I mean, early on, yes. But as you saw every patient, you refined your research idea, that built in more and more confidence. You got one project to completion. You got your second project out the door. You got your third project out the door. Then automatically that imposter syndrome or, changes into confidence and you stop doubting yourself. And you're not afraid to make a statement when it's amongst a large group of people that you believe in. So I think knowing your craft well distinguishes you. If you know what you're doing and you know the disease you're treating, it will go a long, long way. That is from my personal experience. Was I the same clinician? My ethos was probably the same 5 years ago as it is today. How I go about approaching things has obviously shifted, and it's in a much more confident way. I think that's one thing, how I've been able to deal with it. Parts of it still remains at times, but that's good to have a little bit of uncertainty in your own mind, right? Because that's what gives you fuel to keep on going.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think from the perspective of someone who's a learner still, yes, you have all this training and that's been behind you, but then you're also actively learning. And from what you see kind of around you, sometimes you have a lot of questions, and more often than not, sometimes you're afraid to ask those questions for some reason or another. But for me, I'm always like, I'm here to learn. I'm training. This is going to be important when I'm out in the real world, as in like an attending. And so from that perspective, I really just come in from, I'm a learner who is here to learn. And so I ask these questions without the risk of feeling like, oh, they're going to think I don't know anything, because I think a lot of people still think that in the back of their head. But that's not true. You're there to learn. So I think for me, that's kind of how I frame it. And again, just kind of fall back on your training, fall back on your craft, like Dr. Kaur said.
Dr. Carr, I like that you said I taught you something because you taught me something too. And the reminder again that wherever you are in your career, it really is a marathon. And in the academic life, I just started as an assistant professor. I think about, I put this rush on myself to have to get out all these projects and get out all these papers and do all this stuff. And it can be really overwhelming. It can be really difficult to navigate if you don't have a good team. Like you said, I think you said your tribe. I think of it as my herd. Like I think of it, the people in my life that, keep me straight, keep me like focused, keep me energized in my work. And then when they're feeling down, I pick them up too. I think finding folks that you really enjoy working with as collaborators that challenge you and make you a better person in your work and in your research, that challenge you in those good ways where you leave a conversation and you're like, I just have never thought of it that way, and I'm going to need some time to reflect on this. And again, like nursing, very different, and but the academic life, and I have a lot of collaborators who are physicians and in psychology and social work. And we want to have these transdisciplinary research teams. That's the goal. We want to be able to work across disciplines. But that amount of respect and collaboration with others, I think is like, I think it's so critical because that's what you're able to bring back to your profession and to your clinical work too. So thank you all. I very much enjoyed this. It's like when you're re-energized, having moments like this to pause and be like, okay, I have come a very long way. I think you said Nita, 14 years of schooling, and it's sometimes you, when you're so in it and when you're so focused with others around you, you forget how far you have come to be at this point.
Yeah. You know, normally I'm like the there's more senior. Whenever I've been part of a panel, I'm like one of the younger folks, right? I always have more experienced folks. And just being in this panel, I'm like able to reflect. So, 'cause as the, you know, Dr. Khan and Dr. Thakur are sort of highlighting what their journeys are since they were fellows and how they go about it. I'm like, oh my God, like I'm no longer that and how my journey has been. So it's been a really good and it's good to, you know, see that you could also like I'm always the one who's absorbing information from others and saying what I could take on from, you know, how that person is doing this well, that person's doing this well, and what I could learn from them. And so it's sort of you know, different to be in a position where like, okay, I'm the senior most person over here in this space. And, you know, this is how I'm sort of I could give positive I don't know, feedback. I don't know if that's positive feedback is the right word, but you know what I'm saying? Like influence in a positive way. So that's cool. Good that we're doing this. Thanks for having us, Kira.
Absolutely. This has been the most amazing conversation. So thank you all so much for sharing your insights into this. I'm really glad we can get this out on for our audience and International Women's Day. And I'll just say that I feel very privileged to work with so many amazing members of the editorial board and fellows forum. I believe that right now out of our we have 28 total members between the board and the fellows forum, and 16 are women, which I love that we have so much amazing female representation on the board and that we can have these types of panels like this so we can really help convey these experiences to our audience. So thank you all again so much for sharing your insights.
Thank you for having us.